Let me start by asking you what you think your biggest time waster is. As you look at this list, what's your biggest time waster? You don't have to answer me, just answer for yourself. Okay, well, let me tell you that actually your biggest time waster is you. And I say this because each one of us has exactly the same amount of time. We all have 24 hours a day, 168 hours a week. And we may some of us may take slightly more time sleeping, some of us slightly less time sleeping. But basically, we all have the same amount of time. And the question of how we use that time or waste that time is entirely up to us. So, in fact, the term time management is slightly inaccurate. Because since we all have the same amount of time, it's not so much time that we manage as ourselves that we need to manage. And how we manage ourselves is going to dictate how well we use the time that we've got available to us. And so what I'm going to be trying to do over the next hour and a half is to give you some techniques and some ideas about how to use the time that we all have. How to use your time the most effectively possible. And I hope that in doing that, you'll find that you've got, as I think Vlad was saying when he was interviewed this morning, that he found that he actually had, as it's supposed to be, an extra 2 hours a day. I don't know if you'll find that. That's the ideal. But 2 hours a day. Imagine how you would use another 2 hours a day. I hope you would not immediately fill it with more projects. Ideally, what you would fill an extra 2 hours a day with would be some fun, some family time, some enjoyment, some reading, perhaps, that you're not getting to at the moment. But I suspect we could all use another 2 hours a day. And if this is used well, it can certainly make a significant difference, even if not reaching those heights. The key to time management is planning. Planning. Nobody really much likes the thought of planning. It sounds too difficult. It sounds if it's going to really make your mind work. But the fact is that planning can actually put you in the driving seat. It can put you in control of your day. And unfortunately, the alternative to planning is that other people will be in control of your day. That's really the choice. It's either you in control or other people in control of your day. The key to it, as I say, is planning. And planning, when it comes to time management, is a four-stage process. Four-stage process. Goals, priorities, the ideal day, and then a daily plan. So I'm going to go through each of those in turn as part of our basic introduction to time management. And then we will go into a bit more detail about some of the specifics. So this is fairly general. This is kind of overview, basic foundational 101. But without this, none of the rest will work. This is key to making the rest work. Goals. Goals tell us what it is that we want to focus our time on. It's the what. A goal is obviously a predetermined result which we want to achieve by a particular point in time. Goals can be professional or they can be personal. Professional, it could be to, if you were a salesman, to have sold so much goods by a particular date. If you were a writer, to have written a book by a particular point. Or it could be personal, to lose 10 kilos by the end of July. Professional or personal. If it's a big goal, for instance, writing a book, you'd need to break it down into a set of short-term objectives. What do I have to do in order to achieve the goal? So if the goal was to write a book by the end of the year, by the 31st of December, you'd break it down into a series of objectives. Objective one, write the outline. And you might say, well, I could probably write the outline by the 28th of February. Objective two, I could get chapter one written in about 2 weeks. So I'd have that done by the 15th of March, and so on and so on and so on. And that's how it works. We break the big goals down into manageable little chunks so that we know what it is that we're trying to achieve, by when. And then we break down those objectives into tasks. And the tasks tell us, what do I have to do today? A task is really a daily piece of work that I need to do in order to reach the objective. Now this sounds a bit technical and a bit scary, but when you think about it, when you think about something, applying it to yourself, it's not nearly so scary. Let me invite you just to take a moment or two, just think in your head of some big goal that you're trying to achieve. Something you would really like to see happen during this calendar year of 2011. Just think for a minute. Now think, take that task and think, what would, if you had to break it down into some objectives, what would be objective number one? What would be the first stepping stone that you'd need to set, that you could achieve by the end, let's say, of June. And then, having thought about that, think about what you could achieve. Let's give you the rest of this week off to recover from ELF. But what do you think you could achieve as a task on contributing to that next Monday? Does it work? Can you imagine it in your head? Yes? 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 Yeah. It's not as technically difficult as it seems when you start to put some real flesh and blood on it. That's goals. And they're important because it says, what is it I'm trying to do? So then priorities. Priorities tell us, what should I do first? Now, one way of doing this is to use a four-box matrix like this. Low to high, low to high. And on this we have importance and urgency. On the vertical axis, importance. How important is the task? On the horizontal axis, how urgent is the task? In other words, if somebody is beating you about the head, they need this urgently, and you don't think it's terribly important, but it's clearly urgent, then it goes high on urgency. Now, it's obvious that if something is both important and urgent, it must go in box number one. It's high urgency, high importance. So it goes in box one. I would list the things that need to be in there. Then, which is the next one that we should put it in? Should it be high urgency or high importance? Well, strictly it should be high importance. But being human, my sense is that we probably go for high urgency. And I think that's okay, at least for the short term, until the important becomes urgent as well. And then it'll move into box one anyway. So you really want to get through the urgent ones as soon as you can. And as soon as you do, then the next move, supposing we said number two was high urgency, then the next thing to go for is high importance, obviously. And then low importance and low urgency is number four. But let me ask you, it's confession time, folks. Which ones do you usually do first? Into which box does playing Free Cell, for instance, fall? Or Spider, or whatever, or Angry Birds? The trouble is that so many of us do the things that we like doing rather than the things we know we ought to be doing. And I freely confess to being one of those. I'd rather do the things that I like doing, even though they may be both low importance and low urgency, and neglecting the other things. The problem with that, of course, is that it gets more and more urgent, and the box of urgent and important just gets fuller and fuller, and my shoulders get lower and lower because I'm carrying more and more. It doesn't make any sense, but that is in fact what we tend to do, isn't it? I've certainly experienced it. There was a chief executive of a steel company in the US who really disliked consultants, and he tried to outlaw the use of consultants altogether. He didn't completely succeed in his company, but he went a long way towards it. But on one occasion he was walking down the corridor and he met this lady who he didn't know, he hadn't seen before, and he asked her who she was, and she said that she was a consultant. She was on a project for one of his people. And so he thought he would catch her out, and so he said, "Well, I tell you what, I would like to ask you to show me how you could make me more effective in the things that I do every day. And if you can show me how you would do that, then I'll pay you what I think your advice is worth." fair deal, she said. She thought for a few minutes, and then she said this. What I want you to do is to write down all the things that you have to do tomorrow. Just make a complete list, a to-do list. Then, number them in order of real importance and urgency. So, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. Then tomorrow morning, start on number 1. Do it, and don't stop until you've done everything that you possibly can on it. Then, obviously, you may run out of data, or you may be dependent on somebody else for something. Okay, go on at that point to number 2 on the list, and do the same thing. Then, go on to number 3. If you can't finish everything in that day, that's okay. You will have done the most important things. And do that every working day. Well, the chief executive thought that sounded quite interesting. He went away. And 2 weeks later, she received a check for $25,000. And he said to her that he thought that it was probably the most useful piece of advice that he had received over his entire working life. It sounds very obvious. It sounds plain common sense, and it is plain common sense. But how many of us do it? And she certainly did make a difference in that busy chief executive's life. The secret of good time management is basically that you identify your number 1 priority and you do it first. If you're a pastor and you've got a sermon for Sunday, then your number 1 task is to do it first. I have to keep reminding myself of this. It's so easy to get sucked into doing email, sucked into doing things for the church magazine, or sucked into doing this, that, or the other. But my most important, if somebody asks me, what's your most important task? It is to prepare the teaching for Sunday. That's my most important task. I should be doing that first, and not stopping till I've done as much of it as I possibly can. Okay, so we've talked about goals and we talked about priorities. Let's move on to your ideal day, when to do which tasks. On any normal day, you've got a number of regular fixed appointments that you can do nothing about. So that might be if you're a student or a lecturer, perhaps. You've got classes that you have to attend. Perhaps if you're a pastor or a church member, you've got church to attend on certain days, or certain evenings, certain times, certain afternoons, whatever. If you're a choir member, perhaps you've got choir practice. We all have these kinds of things. We have appointments that are fixed without reference to us. In other words, they don't take our vote as to when something is done, or they might do once, but that's it. It's agreed Wednesday evening, 6 o'clock, is the time for choir practice. And it's a voluntary act to join the choir, but once you've joined, it's an obligation to be there for 6 o'clock on a Wednesday. It's not a choice. Everything else that's in our calendar, we can choose when we do it. So, the question is, when shall I choose to do it? Each of us has a personal energy cycle. When am I more able? When am I fresher? When do I operate better? When do I have more energy? When am I more alert? When am I less effective? When do I tend to be sleepy? And so on. And so my ideal day will pin down those times and give me a template for what my ideal day, for what my daily plan should look like. The ideal day would be one that gave me the most work when I was full of energy, when I was most alert, when I was most capable of giving good attention to what's going on, and which then gave me a much easier time, a time when I didn't have to be on top form for my low points. Now, in my own case, I know that I work best from fairly early in the morning. I'm happy to get up early. I like waking up early. I like working through the morning. By about 12:30, 1 o'clock, I'm starting to flag. From 1 o'clock to about 4 o'clock, I'm a zombie. From 4 o'clock to about 7:30 or 8 o'clock, I get a second wind. And I tend to be reasonably functional at that time. From about 8 o'clock, 8:30, I'm starting to flag again. And about, if I just kept on going, somewhere around 9:30, the quality of work that I turn out starts to be really poor. So, that's my daily pattern. You probably know what yours is already. Some people are larks like me. Some people are owls. Some people love to work at night. I know folk who really start to wake up somewhere around 7 p.m. They've been sleepy all day, but 7 p.m. they come to life and they start to really work on all cylinders. That's wonderful. I think mine is probably easier to work with because more people are awake and around during the times that I'm functioning. But it means that I can fix my schedule around those times. And that's what I try to do. Basically, I try to give myself from 1 o'clock till 4 o'clock, I just take time out. If I possibly can. I certainly won't try to do something that's intellectually demanding. If I'm really pushed for time because there's a lot going on, then I'll do something fairly routine that doesn't take a lot of creativity, that doesn't take a lot of energy, that doesn't demand a lot. I'll try to do those things somewhere between 8 and 1, or indeed 8 and 12, to try to get the best time. 4 till 7 I'll probably use as a time when I can catch up on other stuff. It's reasonably okay. I can use it for letter writing, or I can use it for email, or I can use it for those kinds of things. Not stuff that's massively creative, not stuff that's massively demanding, but okay, I can function all right with that. Now, you probably have a different pattern, but what's for sure is that I do need to plan it. When I don't plan well, somebody else will plan it for me, as I told you. Summing up, you need to get number one done in the first in the workday, not after clearing your desk, not after doing email, not after reading the newspaper, not after half an hour of chatting around the coffee machine. You actually need to get number one done first in the workday. you need to do a daily plan. And basically, you need to do a daily plan 1 week at a time. And the recommended good practice is to do a monthly plan for 18 months ahead. Those of us that have been listening to Bob Beale talk this week, he used the idea of what he called an annual plan, which has all your kind of fixed seasons in it. So if you were a pastor, Christmas and Easter are very busy periods. You block those out as time when you can't take, that's not time to take a week of vacation. So you block those out. But you know then when your slack periods are, so that's a good time to take some holiday. And that's how we tend to, that's how you need to do it. The whole idea is to get a picture of what does the year ahead, or indeed the 18 months ahead, look like. And then every week to have a detailed weekly plan of the 5 to 7 days ahead, depending on how many days a week you work. A daily plan looks just like a page in your diary. It starts with goals. It has, it starts for me, it starts at 8 o'clock, and then it has the day going through from 8 o'clock in the morning, hourly, till about 7 p.m. And I block out, as I said, from 1 till 4. It starts with a goal of what I want to try and do that day. And you can see there the kinds of things that I'm talking about. You prepare it weekly, you review it and action it daily. And if anybody wants a template for this daily plan in Word, I'm very happy to give it to you. If you've got a memory stick, I'll happily give you a copy of the daily plan. It's very simple. It's just a one-page thing. What I do is I print it out, and then I fill it in pencil for the week ahead. I find it takes me about 45 minutes, and it's really either the first job that I do on a Monday morning or the last job I do on a Friday night. And I find that that can work well. Of course, the key thing to do is you have to stick to it. It's not worth doing if you don't stick to it. Obviously, some benefits from it. Let me just lay them out before you. A much enhanced sense of purpose. Do you know that feeling of panic when you've got so much to do, you just don't know how you're going to fit it in? Well, I certainly do. And I've found that the plan, the weekly plan, is a sure antidote to that feeling of panic. Now, of course, it's only a temporary antidote if you don't stick to it. Because by the end of the week, you'll be no further forward if you, having done it, you then completely ignore it for the week. The idea is that you actually do stick to it. So if it says 8 till 10, work on sermon, then you need from 8 till 10 to work on the sermon. But the wonderful thing is it stops, once you've got it, it stops that question of, well, what shall I do next? Shall I do this or shall I do that? I've got it planned. In addition, if something interrupts the week, that something unplanned comes along, zap, it's just blown an hour and a half of my time. Okay, well, those things happen. That life is like that. So what I now need to do, I either need to find an extra hour and a half somewhere, or else I need to say I'm going to cut the less important jobs out from this week. They're just not going to get done this week. I'll cut them out and I'll put that hour and a half back into the important jobs. So that the thing that got interrupted does not get derailed. So, in those ways, the plan gives you the ability to have control. It reduces those decisions on what to do next. It improves your output and quality, and it gives you a sense of control over that time. But the big proviso is that you do it and that you stick to it. And when I don't do that, I always regret it. Let's put it all together. You start with the goals. The goals give you some short-term objectives and some immediate tasks. That's the breakdown into what do I do today. You link those activities that you want to do today to the goals, objectives, and tasks. In other words, the work that I do today is contributing to achieving the goal that I want to achieve longer term. I assign priorities to the day's tasks so that I know what needs to be done first. I schedule those tasks according to the priorities and according to my ideal day. When do I have the most energy? When can I afford to let something of secondary importance be done? And then I need to stay on track using that plan to guide me through crises and interruptions, which will come along. That's the one certain thing, is that something will interrupt you one way or another. A lot of this work is based on that very first book, The Time Trap, by Alec McKenzie. I know that's been translated into Romanian, if any of you are Romanian. But it's pretty simple reading in English. I reckon most of you are competent to read it in English. And in fact, I think there's a new edition out since I put this up here. So, warmly recommended. The others are fine too. But the Time Trap is the one that I would certainly recommend. Questions at this point, before we then get into detail.
To put all perspectives and see my priorities at the same time.
Right. That's fair enough. In a way, the boss has the right to set the priorities. Okay. So he or she is in a sense, has first claim on your time. They're the ones who are paying you to do the job, and so it's not unreasonable that they can set the agenda. Now, if that's the case, and if they're saying, what I want you to do, I want you to read my emails, before you do anything else, I want you to read my emails, then you need to put that in box one or two. What that means is that you will then need to exercise iron discipline if you look at email to say, the rest of my email is I'm going to ignore. I will look at emails from the boss, or if I've got two bosses, those two bosses, I will look at those because that will help me to set the agenda. That will give me a sense of what else is important, what else is urgent. So I would treat it that way. But I would use the matrix of important and urgent. Because if your boss is saying, I want you to do this by the end of June, that's okay, but it's not terribly urgent. So that can go high importance, low urgency, probably out to priority three. Does that make some sense?
Yeah.
But what you're doing is, I would normally have said email is probably not at the in my boxes one or two. At the same time, it's what keeps me in touch with people, so maybe it should be. And since I want to read it, you know, I can barely keep my hands off it, I probably have to reckon it should be in one of those. So it has a daily place. I think the trouble is that I find if I put email in box number one and do it first, it can take half a morning. And frankly, that's a waste of my half morning, of my best hours. It's not really the best thing I could be doing. We have developed a culture that says email has to be answered very fast. But it's something of a fallacy. But for the boss, I guess we have to. Unless you can train the boss.
I do my best.
Worth trying. Saying, I will answer your emails, but the standard I'd like to set is that I will answer your email by the end of the day. Not in the first hour of work. Because I'm trying to give my best hours to the work I'm trying to do. If you've got something that you want me to drop everything and start on, pick up the phone.
Yeah. How to communicate fast while not disturbing each other?
Well, the question is, how important is it to communicate fast? Why is it important to communicate fast? If the building's on fire, it's important to communicate fast. But if you're trying to, if you're working on a project, say a team project that needs to be done, then is there really a necessity for everybody to learn about the latest update on that project the instant that something breaks? Perhaps not. Perhaps there's room for a more disciplined approach of saying we'll do a weekly update, or if you like a daily update, but if it's such a big deal. But equally, a team meeting, perhaps. You have a meeting, there's some notes of the meeting which get circulated, but apart from that, the project manager or whoever's responsible just keeps on going with it. Doesn't need to keep the whole team informed minute by minute. I would question the premise. Does that make sense?
Yep. Yeah.
I know communication's important, but I think we over-communicate in some respects because we think it's so important that we just feel as if we've got to do the minute-by-minute update. It's not so. In fact, we weigh down people's email inboxes with it. And we copy everybody. Anything else?
Yeah. I really like your planning, but what if my nature is to do faster and even better under the stress?
Yeah, you're an adrenaline junkie, in other words. Well, I think it is to some extent a matter of self-discipline. I understand that the pressure of the deadline helps you to work more. I question, seriously question, whether it helps the quality of the work. It may help you that you've got a deadline, you know, of 9 a.m. tomorrow morning and say you're going to work all night to do it. But I wonder if the quality of the work wouldn't have been better if you had worked, say, 9 till 12, three mornings of this week, which would have given you 9 hours of work, instead of working from 9 p.m. tonight till 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. I realize that adrenaline has its place and that sometimes you have no option but to work that way. But to deliberately put yourself into that position, I think it's avoidable. And I think it's a matter of I'd suggest it's a matter of self-discipline, which you can perhaps learn. And I can talk some more about that in part two, which we'll come to in a minute. just to clarify, there's a part two of this, which drills down more deeply. I won't be able to go through all of it, but I'll go through whichever bits of it you would like me to, the group votes for. Okay? Pete, did you have a question?
Sorry, it's not a question as much as a comment that Pete
Please.
On the second question. Another book that I found very helpful is by Tim Chester. It's called The Busy Christian's Guide to Busyness.
Brilliant, yeah.
Published by IVP. And it doesn't give... I think it would be a good compliment to these books because he doesn't do the time management techniques.
Thank you.
But he has some very uncomfortable chapters that challenge the ideas of laziness or needing adrenaline in the way we form our work patterns and rhythms. So I found that a very provocative and challenging book, particularly on that issue of being a work to the last minute, being a last minute person.
Yeah.
So I just throw that out there as well.
Pete, thank you. That's a very good point. Tim Chester, The Busy Christian's Guide to Busyness.
And it's available on...
Is it IVP? It's IVP, is it?
It's IVP.
This time it's not a catch question. Let's get a sense of what the worst time waste that you'd most like me to try and address. I just hold hands up if it's something that is something that you would like to talk about. Crisis management. Yes, please do. Okay, read through. Procrastination, in case you don't know what it means. It means putting off till tomorrow what you could have done today. Or putting it off endlessly. Okay. Let's just take a vote if it's something that you think is of those. We'll probably get the chance to address 4 or 5 of them. So think to yourself what your top 4 or 5 would be, and we'll try and get through them. First of all, crisis management. In other words, fighting fires. Okay, that looks like one. Phone interruptions, being interrupted by the phone a lot. Okay, 1, 2, 3. Inadequate planning. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, on that one, we've probably done about as much as we're going to... I probably said about as much as I can reasonably say on planning. Okay? At least for this session. So, I think I would have to say take to heart the things we've talked about already and use the ideas that are there, and I hope that will help. Attempting to do too much. Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Uninvited visitors. 1. Okay. Ineffective delegation. 1, 2, 3, 4. Personal disorganization. Okay, that's pretty clear. Lack of self-discipline. That's pretty clear too, thanks. Inability to say no. Yeah. And procrastination. That means putting off till tomorrow or the next day what you could do today. Okay. I think it's mostly the stuff on the right-hand side, isn't it? Ineffective delegation, personal disorganization, lack of self-discipline, inability to say no, and procrastination. Let's try and work through those, and I'll try and deal with what I can of the others. So let me first of all go to those. Okay, ineffective delegation. I suppose the question is, why do we not delegate better? One reason is we say to ourselves, I can do it better or quicker if I do it myself. Well, the answer to that is we should delegate it anyway, even if that's true, and it probably is true, almost certainly is true. You need to share with somebody else the opportunity to learn to do it as well as you. So give it to them as a learning experience. Give it to them as an opportunity to learn how to do it well. It won't be done brilliantly. It will probably be done less well than you can. It will be done less well than you can. It will certainly be done more slowly than you can. But it's nevertheless worth doing, because that way they'll learn to do it. Second, they may do it wrong. They'll make mistakes. Well, the answer is, delegate anyway. If you don't take risks, you don't get a reward. No risk, no reward. You have to take some risk and tolerate mistakes. Why? Why? What's the reward? You will have more free time, and, well, they learn by mistakes. They'll learn from it. Obviously, you probably don't take risks with your biggest and most important donor, for instance. You don't take risks with somebody who's highly sensitive. But you need to take some risk with something that they can learn to do. I like doing it myself. That's why I don't delegate. I like doing it. I enjoy doing it. It's one of my favorite jobs. What do you think the answer is? You must move on. Delegate anyway. You've got to focus on new things to learn yourself. Even if you like doing it, it's still worth somebody else picking it up and doing it. What if you're not there to do it sometime? Somebody else needs to learn how to do it. It would take longer to explain how to do it than to do it myself. Yes, it almost certainly will. Yes, it will. How often do you want to have to do it rather than to explain it? You see, if you do take the time now, if you invest the time now to explain how to do it, and the person learns how to do it, the consequence is that they will know how to do it. You are free from having to do it. You've got more time for something else. So, delegate it. I'll lose control. I'll lose control. Delegate anyway. You do need to stay in touch, especially if it's a sensitive or delicate operation. You can create checkpoints, so you can ask that means the person who's doing to whom you're delegating it, you say, look, because it's new to you, I'd like you to check in with me, whatever the task is, every couple of hours until you've got it done, or every couple of days until the thing is complete, whatever. But you create those checkpoints, which means that they come back and they say, here we are, I've done this much, have a look, see what you think. And you say, yes, that's great. Which way are you going to go next? And they'll tell you, and you say, yes, although you could have a shortcut that would take you this way. Great, they've learned something, and you've had some input. So that way you stay close to it, but they're still learning. It's a great phrase, I think, this. Do only what only you can do. Now, it's not a universal rule, but it's not a bad one. Do only what only you can do. If you did that, if we all did that, we would have a lot more time available for the things that only we can do. If you keep doing somebody else's work, or work that someone else could easily do, we don't have the time to do the things that only we can do. Okay, so let's go on with this. Some general rules for delegating. First of all, choose the right person. You need to make sure that this person has the skills or the developable skills to do it. It's no use asking somebody to do a job which they're simply not ever going to be capable of doing. That's a cruel thing to do. We talk a game about sending a boy to do a man's job. I think that would be the wrong thing to do. You need to choose the right person for the task that you have in mind. Secondly, give clear instructions. Don't say, I want you to do this job, and then abandon them. You actually need to show them possibly how to do it. You certainly need to make clear what's expected of them. You need to give them a sense of how long they have to do it, what resources they'll need, and what they have a reasonable right to expect. Offer to spend time with them, to show them how to do it, and so on. Don't just abandon them. Don't abdicate. Delegate. Delegation is not the same as abdication. Thirdly, provide the necessary authority. When you delegate something, when you delegate a task to somebody, you need to give them the authority to do whatever needs to be done in it. Give them as much authority as they need to be able to do it, or as much authority as will take them to a stage where you can then give it your seal of approval before it's released. We've talked about follow-up and progress reports, supporting and coaching as needed. Resist upward delegation. Do you understand what I mean by that? Let me explain. Upward delegation means that one of your folk come to you and try to give you a job that they're doing at the moment. That's where they feel as if it's too difficult for them or too complicated or something like that, and they say, you would do it so much better than I would. Please would you take it on? And you are flattered, and you feel it makes you feel good about yourself, and so what do? You take it on. That person has just been very successful at delegating upwards. That's not the idea at all. If somebody does that, what you need to do, what do you need to do? What do you think?
Help,
yes, certainly. You could give them some advice. What are you finding so difficult? What's the problem here? Good. What else?
Set up a meeting when we can help. So not now, so they don't interrupt us.
Perhaps. Give them some training. Set up some training for them. If where you're having trouble is with the computer software or something, let's set up a training course for you so that you know how to use it properly.
Encouragement.
Certainly encouragement. You can do it. You've done it before. It's only a bit more complicated this time. Have a go. I'm sure that you're capable of doing it, but if you find that you're needing some help, come back and I'll give you a bit more guidance. But this is your job. You know how to do it, and I'm confident that you're able to do it. But the key is certainly helping them with the basic competence of doing it, but not taking it away from them. It needs to stay firmly on their backs, not transferred to yours. If you don't have anybody to delegate to, and you need to share some of the things, then consider trading off with colleagues so that you do the things that you're good at and they do the things that they're good at. You say, I'll do that task for you if you'll do this task for me. That's another possibility. Using their gifts, helping them when they're stretched, when they're pushed for time, piling in and giving a hand with their stuff. Because if you do that, then maybe they'll help when you're pushed for time. Any questions on that one? Pete?
How do you deal with it when you're relating to volunteers, you're delegating, particularly in the church context or a voluntary ministry or something mm-hmm. like that? They come to you saying, I really don't want to do, or I don't feel I can do this job. And you can say, you can encourage them, you can say, I can help you to some extent,
yeah.
but they say, no, really, I can't, and boom, that's it, they drop yeah. it. How do you help both give them a sense of responsibility, but also, yeah, what do you do with that? Because does that then become crisis management in some respects?
Yeah, to some extent. Any comments? Anybody like to volunteer a suggestion? Volunteers are a whole separate game, aren't they? They're not straightforward. Volunteers are complicated because you don't have a handle over them. You don't have the same kind of management controls over them. So you certainly can't force somebody in that situation. It's much more tricky than a normal sort of employee type role. I think that I might question a bit, what is it that you're finding difficult? Why is it that you can't do the job? I've always thought that you're so competent at this that I'm surprised that you've hit a roadblock here. Of course we'll help in any way that we can. Would it help if we put somebody, got somebody else alongside you to work with you on it? In order to be able to sort it out. What if we got you some training? I'd probably try those tacks. But if they don't work, then I think you just have to accept it with a good grace. Say, yeah, okay, of course. We certainly don't want to make your life a misery. Thanks for all you do. We'll take it away from you and we'll give it to somebody else. In that case, your job then is to find somebody else to delegate it to, not necessarily to take it on your own back. If you can possibly avoid taking it on your own back. Well, yes, if they volunteered specifically for this kind of thing and suddenly they're walking away. I think we probably also need to think in terms of backup and succession planning of some kind. We have a magazine that goes out that has advertisers and so on. If the chap that's running it was suddenly taken ill, unable to produce it, what's the backup plan? Yeah, quite true. All right. Anything else? Let's move on. Personal disorganization. Quite a few people picked this one up. There's a bunch of symptoms for personal disorganization. The desk is piled high. There's lots of post-its on things. The in tray is full. And you can't find papers when you need them. And there are deadlines and appointments that are being missed. Does that sound familiar to anybody at all? It's like looking in a mirror for me. It's certainly, my desk looks like this at the moment. The fact is that nobody likes to be disorganized. It's a horrible feeling. So I'm sympathetic, but there are some things that we can do about it. And it's simply a matter of putting it on the weekly plan as a high priority. So, here we go. The first thing we do is we put this task high on the weekly plan. Tidy your desk. Everything that's on the desk, either throw it away, file it, give it away, or clear it. No, and clear it. Get rid of it. Clear it by actioning it if you can. If the reason that it's sitting on your desk is it's waiting for an email to be sent, then put it into a folder marked emails to be sent, because that's something that will need to be done. This may be an all-day task, but the main objective for this one is by the end of that period, whatever it is, let's say it's a day, and I doubt that it's longer. At the end of that day, you've got a clean desk, and the tasks that were associated with that desk are done. I bet that a lot of the stuff that's sitting in that inbox or sitting in heaps on your desk are old magazines waiting with an article in them that was waiting to be read, papers that you brought back from a meeting, which either need to be filed, or if you've got an electronic copy on your computer, can be thrown away. And so on. Much of it is stuff that you can and should recycle. I know that it is the case with mine. The problem is, because we're short of time, we don't tend to maintain it that way. But what we need to do is clean it. You'll feel fantastic when it's clear, but we then need to keep it that way. Does that sound doable? That's the first step to an organized life. You need then to have an integrated system of goals and projects and daily plan. Essentially, that means a file of facts or a PDA. I've put a palm there, it's old technology, an iPhone or whatever it might be, an Android. Something of that kind, but you need an integrated system of which will enable you to keep your goals and your diary and your projects and your daily plan together. You need a filing system of some kind. I don't know if you've got a filing system, a filing cabinet, a filing some way of keeping your files, but you need one. If you haven't got one, you can buy a filing system a filing cabinet of some kind, pretty inexpensively. You can use eBay, or you can probably pick one up quite inexpensively. In the UK, we have charity shops. I don't know if you have them in your country, but a charity shop will often have a filing cabinet going quite inexpensively. Or you can buy a nice new zippy one that you can put your files in. The important thing is that you can keep things properly categorized. The important thing is that you know where to retrieve a particular piece of paper. You don't file it just for the sake of getting it off your desk. You file it so that when you need it, you can get it back again. And if you can't do that, then the filing system's no good. So you need to think through your filing system fairly carefully. A lot of my files I keep electronically. I just keep them on my computer. If it starts out as paper, I often scan it and then put it onto the computer, because then I can get rid of the paper. It makes it a lot easier to keep. That's one way. But if it's a document, a fairly long document, or I need to keep the document, a lease or something like that, where I need to keep an original, I need to know where it is and how to keep it. Okay? So, filing system. And then for all your current papers, you need to keep them in folders of some kind. A folder or a document wallet or a plastic wallet of some kind. And those folders are action, phone or email, reading. So that's for the articles that you want to read someday, but which obviously weren't important enough to read there and then, and filing. And empty those folders often, so they don't get thicker and thicker and thicker. So you need to keep them and keep them regularly cleaned out. And check them daily. Just check them daily. And don't hoard stuff. Throw it away. For some people, that's really, really hard. They even find it hard to throw away the daily paper when they're finished with it. They think it might come in useful someday. Believe me, it won't. I know you'll tell me, well, there was this really good article, now you made me throw it away. Often you can retrieve an article online. You're better off without it, trust me. That's personal disorganization. Anything? Anything you would like to ask about? Probably the really important one there is the filing and how well you do that. You can get books and stuff on that. There's probably something on the internet about it. Lack of self-discipline. As it says, self-discipline is a habit, and so is a lack of self-discipline. How to deal with it? Well, first of all, it is worth checking the basics. Doing a check on your own health, on your tiredness, because often the lack of self-discipline comes because we haven't got the energy to be disciplined. So it might be something like diet, exercise, sleep. Sleep especially, you know, we develop such bad sleep habits, most of us. Most of us don't get enough sleep. The Western world has developed very dysfunctional sleeping habits. There was a journalist, Matthew Paris, in the UK, who described how he went to Africa and he was in the Kalahari Desert, down in southwest Africa, with a tribe of Bushmen, and he described how really they pretty much went to sleep when the sun went down, and they woke up when the sun came up, which is about a 12-hour span, a little less than a 12-hour span, because it's quite a way south of the equator, probably 10 or 11 hours. So they would eat their supper, they would have the have a fire, they'd go to sleep. So the first few days it was very strange. But then after about 3 or 4 days of this kind of regime, because they were out in the desert and they were trekking during the day, they were really tired by the time it came to the end of the day. So they would get to sleep quite easily. They'd sleep through the night. He said after about 3 or 4 days, he found that all of his senses were much more alert, much more acute. He could hear better. He could smell better. He could see better, he thought. Food tasted better. Everything was functioning as it should be. He was able to go through the day very comfortably without feeling tired during the day. I suppose the moral of the story is that we tend to really burn the candle at both ends. We stay up late, we get up early. Sometimes we stay up very late and we get up a bit late. And we deprive ourselves of sleep more and more. And we spend a lot of our time feeling a bit tired. So it's one of those things that we need to bear in mind. Because what it does is it does impact our self-discipline. Because it's one of the things that just that goes away. We can talk to ourselves, I won't accept this lack of self-discipline, I want to be orderly and organized. Well, maybe. That's a little bit like, as Richard was saying this morning, I can, I can, I can, or I can't, I can't, I can't. Excuse me. Try to act as you think a self-disciplined person would, and build in reinforcement of these behaviors all the time. As far as your goals are concerned, keep them visible. Put them on your mirror or something like that where you shave in the morning. But let's see. Self-discipline is really one of those things that we just have to try to work on. I think that I would go further and say it's something that we need the Spirit's help with.
Just in terms of time and sleep and those type of things, in our course and network, I remember that Bob had said, if you're going to be an executive, you're going to be doing probably on average
56 hours, I think.
56 hours a week, so cut that to 55 just to make it a nice round number. You're working a five day week, that's 11 hours a day.
Yeah.
Plus 7 plus 8 hours worth of sleep, if you're saying get your sleep time back, right? That gets us 19 hours, a couple of hours for meal time to look through with the family, if we can possibly do that. I need to get up and wash and dress, I need to try and go to Actually, I have no particular then value for life, but my church, where do I go to house group, where do I do my elders meetings?
Yep.
This is the difficulty that I'm finding in Christian ministry is I want to do it well.
Yep.
I do work quite long hours in terms of trying to burn the candle and meeting lawyers. And I work in an environment where everybody seems to work more than 24 hours a day.
Yes.
But I feel tired.
Yeah.
and you start to kill yourself or kill your family life. And the difficulty is that we reinforce that by having seven narcissists. We're going to be working an average of 55 hours a week. So get rid, change that. So do we have to start disciplining ourselves in the Christian communities to say, look, 40 to 45 hour week really should be something that we're aiming for to enable us to have a healthy lifestyle outside of that, or else my children are going to be saying, I never see you that.
Yeah. I think that there's some, absolutely, and that even doesn't allow for commuting time if you have to commute, and for many people commute is an hour each way, minimum. So you add 2 hours each way. If it's 5 days a week, that's 10 hours that you're adding into it. I do think that that. 55, 56 hours as a work week is not untypical, even of a minister's life, for instance. A friend of mine who's been in the ordained ministry for most of his life, he was working much more than that, and he had a bit of a breakdown, and he went into it to see what was typical for, or what was desirable, if you like. And most, when he consulted around the place, he found that 55 hours was viewed as manageable, certainly for most people in their, you know, until, say, late 50s. From 20s to late 50s, that was perfectly manageable. You start to slow down a bit at that point. You have to cut it back to about 50 hours. But that was typical of the findings. I think the fact is that work's not getting any less. We may not like it, but it's probably the case. As far as church life is concerned, if we load ourselves up with guilt, more importantly, if we load ourselves up with a lot of church life, then what we're doing is we're taking away even more from that. So we need to be wise on what we choose to do. We have to prioritize. I don't like to separate between church life and work life, because I think they're both are part of what we're called to as Christians. So, and I don't think there's anything wrong with actually having to work those sorts of time. Actually, 55 hours, sorry, I'll be right with you. I think 55 hours, we're getting away with quite a light work schedule compared to investment bankers, certainly major corporate law firms. I mean, they're doing... Yeah, sure. Investment bankers, many are burnt out by the time they're 30. Who wants that for a life? I don't. But we need to be wise in our use of, as well, of sleep. I don't have any easy answers on it. Sorry about that.
One question about self-discipline is passion.
Pressure?
Passion.
Passion.
I have some colleagues who are very great on this. They have no passion. Because passion is something that you're quite asleep, and then it comes, and you cannot stop. Until it doesn't come, you cannot really start. And those people who are great in self-discipline, I found out they are bad in passion. I'm a very passionate guy, and I really feel hard to start work.
Yeah.
And sometimes really hard.
Well, I agree with you. I'm not sure that I have any answer to that. I think that being self-disciplined doesn't necessarily mean being void of passion. But I think it means knowing when to say stop. Being self-disciplined means being willing at some point to say, thanks guys, but tonight I'm going home. I'm going to have a break. I'm going to stop. And I can do that with a clear conscience because I know that I've run today in a disciplined way. I've done the best I can. I don't simply live to work. I work to live. I'd love to go on, but I think we're at the end of our time. So, folks, thank you very much for your attention. It's been a joy. I hope this might be of some benefit and value to you in the future. God bless.